podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Wales in real trouble here, although they're lucky to get that loose ball. Gibbs with the thrust. Robert Jones, nicely out to Emir Lewis. Emir Lewis's chip kick up goes Yian Evans. Yian Evans is away. Can the Welsh captain make it? He's going to do it. And it's a try for Wales. And the Welsh captain has scored his 8th and his 37th.
Welcome to another episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast. We've got a fantastic lineup for you this evening. We're joined by the man in form, the mighty Murph. How are you, Murph?
Very well, yeah. Well, probably couldn't be better. I couldn't imagine after yesterday.
We have got one of the founding fathers of the podcast, Daniel Killick. How are you, Dan?
Absolutely exceptional, Jed. Thank you.
I thought you might
Come
be.
On. Come on.
I'm delighted to say that the guest this week is Geraint Davis. How are you doing, Geraint?
Yeah, very well. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm still smiling.
Yeah, we were just saying there with the before we turn the microphones on that you're going to have to be the grown up in the room, and that's why we brought you on to add a bit of balance and a bit of proper analytical when we throw over to Murph to do the gloating. But yeah, a fantastic lineup, and we've got stacks to get through. Pretty much everything is going to be centered around that incredible Triple Crown victory in Cardiff yesterday, and I'm very much looking forward to getting stuck into that. But before we do, just a quick word for our sponsor. I'm delighted to say that this episode of the Attacking Scrum podcast is sponsored by the Pascal Gauzère stand-up tour, Live and Dangerous 2021. Fresh from his controversial but incredibly amusing set in Cardiff yesterday, he'll be coming to a ground near you soon, so make sure you do check that out. One such reviewer who I know was very, very keen on that was Dan Killick. Dan, where do we start? Like, because I know we're going to talk about the ref, but there was plenty in there to be happy with from a Wales perspective. You know, there are those kind of games that we've thrown away in the past, and you know, as we said on the pod a couple of weeks, I've been a bit sceptical about the optimism around this side, and thought Wales got a bit lucky in the first couple of games. But I think there was a lot more substance to that performance for me. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I thought it was a really great performance. I mean, we put 40 points on England, didn't we? You almost don't need to look beyond that, really. But yeah, fantastic performance. You know, a lot of the boys had top games, and I thought you could really see sort of Pivac's style throughout that performance. Really, we played really well in the wide channels, didn't we? Had a lot of forwards out wide, and yeah, it was super exciting. I mean, we look really dangerous, don't we? When we get opportunities, and we're winning. I'd say that at the moment we haven't quite clicked. It's not perfect at all. It's pretty rusty in patches and a bit sort of stop start still. But yeah, fantastic performance. England, for me, there was a load of dull play though. Really silly play from them. Obviously the pen count has been well documented, but they looked super dangerous out wide. I was worried when they went wide. I was it didn't look good at all from a Welsh perspective. But they didn't do enough of it, did they? And yeah, we found a way around. I thought tactically we were really astute. We looked really switched on, and yeah, top performance.
Well, the man who knows all about tactics is, of course, Geraint. What did you make of the tactical battle between the two sides? Was it a Pivac masterclass? Eddie Jones get things wrong, or a bit of both?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting watching the way that Wales have progressed since the autumn, which obviously they needed to. I think there's a clear evidence that there is a plan. I mean, and there's a plan that really suits the players, which I think has adapted loads since the autumn. So yeah, I think Wim Pivac deserves a lot of praise for what he's achieved. I think Gethin Jenkins, you know how long it takes to organise a knighthood, but he can't be too far off. I think he's the turnaround of the defensive systems and the attitude of players to defend and the way that they want them to do it. That's an incredible result in a fairly short space of time, really, at the top level. So, I think Wales have got a lot to be proud of with their development. And you look at the way that England played. I mean, I agree with Dan in terms of the intensity, that when they had quick ball, they were startlingly good, where they had front foot possession and they could maintain possession for a number of phases. But you know, when got players dropping balls with no reason to be dropping balls with very little pressure, it's hard to build and maintain good field position. And then just some very, very peculiar decision making for certain players in the ruck area, giving away very silly penalties. But you know, Eddie Jones has got his approach, isn't he? I mean, we might have comment on his approach, but I think there comes a point, and I think Pivac, in fairness to him, he recognised the way the Wales were playing just wasn't quite right. Has made some fairly significant tweaks in some places and smaller ones elsewhere. I've not seen that from Eddie Jones, really. I've not really seen a change to the system or the approach, and again the same results. So it probably is a bit of a reflection of the coaching decisions.
Yeah, well, I mean, famously, I predicted England to get a Grand Slam at the start of this tournament. I think I've also predicted a Wales defeat in every single one of these games. So
keep going,
you know. Yeah, that's it. I'm definitely going to do that. Italy and France will definitely do us over. But we're talking there about Gethin Jenkins. But I suppose other areas that went well. Murph, we were talking about it before we came on air. The lineout in particular, it seemed to be, you know, no nonsense, but just got really good change out of the driving lineup.
Yeah, it didn't start great. I think we lost the first one, did we? Maybe. I mean, from then on, it was really reliable. Back to probably as good as it's been in the last few seasons. But I mean, we still throw to the front a lot, which in a way is admitting defeat. It's not prime attacking ball if you're throwing to the front. But because we mentioned the driving mauls transformed from where it was in the autumn. It's worthwhile because we can buy in yards out of it and we can launch from there. But everything, I mean, the scrum came together in the first game of the Six Nations, and it's just got better and better. The lineouts improved steadily, and like Geraint said, the defence is unrecognisable from the Irish game. And so once you got that, and then, you know, those three things, and your kicking is improved because Callum Sheedy picked up from his first appearance. A little bit like, if you remember, Gareth Anscombe in 2019, his kicking was off in the first few games, and obviously Neil Jenkins gave him a Roger in. That's not the word. A few masterclasses on the kicking, and just turned him around to really reliable test level, and that's what's happened to Callum Sheedy. So, they're the fundamentals. Your defence, your set piece and your kicker. If you haven't got that, you can't really be in test matches. So all those things have improved, and here we are, staring down a Grand Slam.
I know, this is it. Well, let's get on to some of the listeners' questions. And we've kind of talked about Sheedy, and as you can imagine, this has kind of dominated a fair amount of questions coming in. And I'm trying to pick out who the first person to actually mention it was. There we go, John Davis, funny enough. Does Sheedy start against Italy with Evans potentially as a replacement? I mean, the temptation is to not want to experiment too much. We've spoken about this in the past, Dan. But Sheedy looks the man in form. Would you be tempted to start him?
I would be tempted to start him, but I wouldn't change too much now. I think we have made a lot of changes, haven't we, throughout the autumn, and we're still trying to find combinations that are working. You know, we've had a lot of changes at nine, haven't we? I think I'm tempted, yes, but I would keep with keep doing what we're doing, basically.
Yeah. What about you, Murph? Would you be bringing Sheedy into the starting lineup?
One of the issues they've got to confront is there's a gap week again before the last game, is there? And so
we've got a gap now, and then back to back.
So. Yeah. You would want to, if we're having a gap, that means Sheedy and Bigger are probably going to run out for their clubs. And then the temptation would be to keep them in the squad for the Italy game, to bed them back in ready for France, if that makes any sense, rather than giving Jared a run. So I think they might flip them. They might flip Sheedy as starter, but I don't think they'll change. I don't think they'll bother with Jared. We know that Pivac tried to get Rhys Priestland in the squad. So how keen is he on Jared to start?
We discussed this in the past. I think he's probably some way down the pecking order. I think you're right. If you had a game, if there was perhaps a particular cause for wanting to rotate the squad. You know, if it was an autumn international series or something like that, then maybe. But I just don't think there's a temptation to, you know, they'd resist the temptation to meddle too much with it. Halfbacks is, I mean, it's something that we have spoken about throughout Pivac's time in charge. And obviously a very eye-catching second half from Kieran Hardy. What did you make of his performance, Geraint?
Yeah, massive fan of how he played. I think he's a player that's has come on really nicely in the kind of Pro 14, and he's put in some solid performances, obviously with Scarlett. And then, I mean, in terms of competition at your own club, it's, you know, it's not bad going, is it, to have the other international nine at your own club, which sometimes could be not a great thing. But he's had plenty of opportunity. So I was really impressed with him. I thought he was quality. Gareth Davis, I rate him highly. I still think the best scrum half in Wales is not in the squad, but I think I was still really impressed with the way that he played and way that he managed possession. I thought his kicking game in particular was outstanding. I think, you know, Wales didn't box kick a massive amount, but I thought when they did it, I thought he did it with real accuracy. So I thought he was solid. And in terms of consistency, I think probably Wales need a little bit of that right now. So I would be quite happy to see him starting again.
Yeah, I it was really his second half performance. I thought he was solid, but there was a couple of shaky things in the first half. Obviously, he got charged down by Itoje, which could have, you know, which could have ended in a try, and got snagged a couple of times. But I was really impressed with the way he bounced back in the second half and looked really composed, and none more so than taking his opportunity. You know, that quick tap was a complete, you know, I know it wasn't technically the match-winning moment, but it's moments like that that you win a test match on. So I think that was a big step up for him. We've had this question in from the Dragon Thistle Rugby Pod. If both are fit, who would be your starting nine, Thomas Williams or Kieran Hardy? Who wants to field that one? Go on, Murph.
Kieran Hardy was great. I keep thinking of him as a pup on the scene, but he's actually 25.
He is, yeah.
So because of his age, he's going to be around the squad for seasons to come, because all the others are 30 plus. You know, like Gareth is 30, obviously Lloyd Williams is 30 plus. Mm. And so it's him and Thomas. And of the two, I think Thomas is the better nine. So, but he's not going to be fit. I don't think he's going to be fit in time for Italy or France. So
no, I wouldn't expect
it'll be as you were, I think, for the rest of the tournament. Because, like we said, where's the point in changing a winning side like that? So.
Yeah, definitely. What about you, Dan? Where do you stand on those two nines?
I really like Kieran Hardy. I think he's an excellent player. There's something about Thomas Williams isn't the complete nine for me, and I think that we've been talking about this for quite a while, haven't we? That our nines have aspects, each one of them we'd like to put together to make the complete nine. Arguably, you know, I would say Webb is that nine that has everything when he's absolutely firing. He's firing he is firing at the moment, isn't he? But the other nines have bits that they need to work on. Kieran Hardy, I think, is really exciting. His support lines are fantastic. And when we get more of an offloading game going, I think we'll see more tries from him. I agree with Geraint. I thought his kicking game was good. They were contestable kicks, weren't they? And put pressure on England. And, you know, I said it last week that the boys, their back three are prone to making errors. You know, certainly this campaign, and I'd say going back, not last year. Last year they were probably as error free as they've been, but before that they were as well. So. Yeah, I think he gave a real dynamism to the back line. It was a whip of a service. He was quick. He looked sharp. Looked dangerous. And yeah, looks to be good.
Yeah, Geraint, this is a question in from Greg Sherrington. How good was the game management in the last 15-16 minutes when the score went to 24-all? I mean, that was the bit for me. As I've said in the past, I've yet to have been converted into, you know, a big, not that I'm not a Pivac fan, but, you know, I hadn't seen a huge amount to suggest that Wales are there yet. But that last 16 minutes, that to me was really, really impressive to not just, you know, not just sneak it with one penalty, but to comprehensively outplay England and nil them. And I think particularly with the game management, what did you make of that period of play?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I've been talking a lot about restarts recently, and particularly restarts when there's that kind of thing happens. So we go 24 all, the next restart is essentially who's going to go ahead next. And Alan Wynne-Jones, ball above his head, just an absolute peach of a take, perfect lift. And the moment that was taken, I thought Wales just looked really, really assured. And while I felt really nervous in every Welsh game so far, it's the least nervous I felt so far, to be honest. I think I was emotionally in a bit of a state, but it, just in terms of the nerves of thinking, how is it going to go? You just felt so assured with it. Really good start from me, good carries into contact, kicked accurately, put pressure on, and just got into the right areas of the field. So I think it's the most composed Wales have looked in those type of situations so far. I thought their choice of strategy across the park and when to kick, just thought it was really well measured. And you know, big applause to Sheedy, really. You know, he didn't kick particularly well when he came on against Scotland. Just nailing those from the right hand side. You only need 3 points at that point, and just kind of kept the scoreboard ticking over. So yeah, you know, I was really impressed. Restarts in particular, other than the last one, which George Ford played a blinder with, in fairness, with a little short kick at the end. I thought we built our field position really well and looked really comfortable on the ball.
Murph said it there as well, that you know, obviously you had a shaky time off the tee against Scotland. I suppose, you know, like coaching in the international setup is very, very difficult because you have limited time with the players. It's not something you're able to do. But I guess kicking is one of those things that you're able, particularly if you've got a coach like Neil Jenkins, it is one of those things that you will be able to do a bit of intensive preparation. Is that, you know, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the type of thing you only need small tweaks, really. I mean, he's got a different kicking style. It's not conventional. His run-up isn't conventional. He's quite straight on, strikes the ball across. It's like a natural draw. So actually, they said in commentary, you've got a natural draw on the ball. So it's hardly conventional, but it's only like very few tweaks you have to make, really. It looks like he's approaching the ball slightly more of a relaxed angle. And then just looks like he's got a bit more, slightly better cadence coming into the strike. It is that then you can get big gains in short space of time, and who better than Neil Jenkins to give you a couple of pointers?
Yeah, it's not the prettiest looking kick, is it? That, you know, when you compare it to, you know, to Bigger and Halfpenny, you're kind of absolute like gun barrel straight. And but it looked so effective. I thought and I think the big thing is you can be an excellent kicker, but if your nerves go in those big games, then that can be such a telling thing. And you're right. I didn't feel like he was going to miss those kicks. And I don't know that I've ever felt that relaxed going into a last 10 minutes against England. Murph, I can see you smiling away there. Like, you know, once he slotted some of those kicks, it felt like the pressure was off.
Turning the screw, he was. Jed, it's turning the screw.
But he was really like it felt like that. And then, you know, I know we mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that the bench was impressive against Scotland, and I felt even more so against England. They, you know, some really big performances off the bench. What did you make of the replacements?
I was thinking earlier, not only was the bench great yesterday, but there's potentially more to come from the bench. Like Rob Evans would obviously, if it take Roger Jones's place at the moment. Ellis Jenkins has just come on and just been a man of the match machine in the last 3 weeks, is it? Maybe less than that. So,
two league games and a friendly,
yeah, isn't it? I mean, don't get me wrong, James Bolton has been really like more impressive off the bench than he is when he starts. I think he really gets the idea that he's got to come on and make an impact kind of thing. And he seems to just come in and be an absolute pain in the ass for the opposition straight away from the get-go, which is what you want. I mean, he's a back row anyway, it's his job, but you know what I mean. Doesn't hang around. And, I mean, Leon Lloyd, I've already mentioned him in the other week after the, was in Ireland, we were scrumming on our own line and he came on and was solid, which is he hadn't been in the past. So Corey Hill's scoring record against the English. Come on.
It's incredible.
It was just unreal. I mean, you know, it's one of those, all the pubs are bloody shut in Cardiff, right? And no one was there. That would have been Wembley 99 type of level night out.
I think you're right.
It could be one of those, you know, in a different era, Max Boyce would have written a bloody song about it. There would have been poetry about it. It was just unbelievable from start to finish. But because, like, in a way, it was a tree falling in the woods and there was no one there to hear it. So did it even, I mean, it happened, obviously. But it just hasn't, the magnitude of yesterday hasn't, aside from on Twitter, where everyone's gone mad, it hasn't really landed, like, in the public. I should be, like, on the sofa dying right now from being out, from being out all night last night, but I've just had a few cans and a brandy and coke last night, you know, at home watching what was on Bloody Apocalypse Now. There was nothing else to do. I couldn't go out. You know, that's how weird it all is. Yesterday and this weekend, it should have been like the last days of Rome in Cardiff, but it should have
been Apocalypse Now in terms of a night out. Yeah. not watching it on the TV.
One of my mates said when he was on the there's a quote from Apocalypse Now, the horror is Colonel Kurt. That was all the English fans going home. If there'd been any English fans, there was no English fans here. That, you know, the barber jackets and the yellow cords, yeah, all trying to get on the train before any Welsh fans can speak to them. None of that. Nothing could happen after. You couldn't even celebrate. So
in many ways, that is the true cost of not having any fans in the stadium. And the thought of those mustard corduroys heading those big snaking queues to get back to London. But there we go. I mean, look, I suppose we've spoken about how good Wales were, and I think we definitely need to do that. But obviously, two massive refereeing decisions have kind of dominated the write-ups here. Geraint, I'm going to turn to you for this one again, perhaps mainly because I couldn't stop laughing when it happened. But with both of those, I mean, the second one, I think in particular, there seems to be, if you look on social media for the right answers, you know, there seems to be a lot of people saying that it wasn't a knock-on because it didn't touch the ground and it hit hit the defending player on the way back. I mean, that to me was the most clear-cut knock-on that I've ever seen. You know, I think if he'd have given that in real time, no one would have batted an eyelid. What is the correct decision in that scenario?
The referees. Oh, it's a tough one. I mean, when I first saw it, I was utterly convinced that it was coming back for a knock on. So that was my first thought. Obviously, Zamek was over, and you could thankfully finish that phase of playoff because I was pretty certain that he thought it was a knock on at that point as well. Initially looking at it, and then they obviously go through the replays and they start to kind of discuss all the things have happened on the ball's route down to the ground. Obviously Nigel's at his say as he likes to, as to whether it was a knock on or not. And I mean, some of the laws in rugby are really clear cut. Like, they're black and white, and there's no debate in them. This is one of them where we've found a grey area that maybe didn't even know was there. I look at it now. And if I was having to make a judgment, I'm not a referee, by the way. If I had to make a judgment based on what I see with it, it looks like a knock-on. Like, it looks to me to be a knock-on. But the referee has interpreted, and the video ref has interpreted it, that the ball has travelled downwards towards the foot. It's then travelled backwards off the foot. Or how do you determine whether it was actually knocked forward initially? It's then made contact with another player, void in the ground. I mean, there's a lot in there. I'm happy to stick to the experts making that decision, and they went with the try. So.
Well, talking of experts, I can see I'm just getting a call in my ear from the TMO, the television Murph official. Go on, Murph, what have you seen?
Well, I just wanted to go over it again in detail, because when they went to the TMO, I imagine it's because they were making sure it wasn't knocked back by an English player, because there was a contest and it sort of went to ground. And I thought, well, okay, they must just be just making sure it was on knocked back, because Neil Williams had gone on to score. So then they showed it, and it hadn't been knocked by an English player. It was just a Welsh player dropping the ball. But then they rolled it on, and you can see it went down and hit his leg and went backwards. And the issue with the ruling is, as Geraint just covered, if you lose a ball, it's not a knock on until it hits the ground or another player. But having it the ground or another player. That's like, I mean, I should have got the rule book out just to double check. But that is, as it's always been, in the spirit of the game, he's lost control of it. And Nigel Owens has been on media and said, if he doesn't regather it, he's lost control of the ball. If he doesn't regather it himself, it's a knock on, in his opinion. And I mean, I used to like the guy, but but technically, on a technicality, and no one up in Twickers is liking this, it hasn't touched the ground and it hasn't touched another player. Before it did hit the ground, it's hit the back of his leg and gone backwards. So, like, if it hadn't been with the fact he'd gone to the TMO to double check an English player hadn't touched it, we wouldn't, that would have been ruled out. If there was no one near him and he just did that, it wouldn't have gone to the TMO. It would have been given a knock on and Liam wouldn't have gone on to score. So it's such, I mean, anyone who has that try given against them is not going to be happy.
No, I'd agree with that. And it's
I think it's a much fairer try than the other controversial try.
Let's get Dan's thought on the first try there. What was your take on this one, Dan?
So I just thought we were alert and England were caught napping, really. Obviously, it's all over Twitter, isn't it? That people have counted. I think 26 seconds seems to be sent around between Pascal saying have a word with the team. And if you look at some of the shots from above, you can see that out wide to the right, England are set pretty much, and there's. You know, there's three players then in front of foul that are looking towards Bigger and the ref, obviously. And there's a few there's a number that aren't. And then you've got Watson that's completely come in and come off his wing, which, you know, you've got to be more alert than that, haven't you? I would say. And Ford is then trying to cover for him and help him out, really. But it's not for him to do, really. But so I think. Yeah, it's they're going to be aggrieved, but I don't think there's much in that, to be honest. They should have been alive to it, and you know they weren't alive to it later on with the Hardy try as well, were they? So they were caught napping. You know, you've got to keep your eye on the children.
Yeah, I'm going to throw this over to Murph as well, because I know he's bouncing with excitement on this. What I would say quickly, again, I'd have been raging if either of those had been given against Wales, by the way. But I think the one thing I would say is Bigger, you know, so alert. He doesn't just take the kick. He's there in Gozer's ear, is the time on, bang, kick over to the corner, executed perfectly, you know, proper. Catching them with their pants down. You know, that deserves credit for that. You know, for that level of alertness to do it. But go on, Murph. What were you going to add?
I just wanted to point out that Bigger didn't kick to Johnny May's wing because Johnny May realised they hadn't signalled for posts and stayed on his wing. So most of the time when a captain gets told to talk to his players, he's only going to talk to the forwards anyway, and whoever's in the area. He's not going to go around every single 14 players. So Johnny Mays realised they haven't signal posts and just stayed exactly where he would be. Anthony Watson has come in to have a chat. And that's what's happened. I mean, that try is the one that if they'd ruled it out, I wouldn't argue, you know, at all. I mean, obviously if it was given against you, you'd be cheesed off. But the fact that it's us against England, it just makes it all the more delicious.
And then just get your take on it as well, Geraint. I mean, there's no reason really to rule the try out, but it's controversial officiating, isn't it?
You know, I'm party to the additional angles, which in fact I've just been looking at the rechecking while you've been chatting, just to make sure I'm 100% accurate in what I'm seeing, because you get an opinion, but you want to always check your opinion. From what I'm seeing from the addition angles, both Elliot Daly and Johnny May recognise the threat and then get straight out to cover across. Farrell had more than enough time. Gozer walks over to them, tells them, or kind of almost feigns towards a warning towards them. Two players then leave. Daly and May then leave and go to the left edge. Ben Youngs then is on the right hand side of the mall. He's walking like nothing's happened. Like they accepted the go for 3 points and Wales are taking advantage of it. Now, a few years ago when the penalty try ruling came in that you didn't go for a conversion, teams were being applauded for rushing halfway and taking a kickoff. And a couple of teams at top level scored tries from it. And everybody was saying how wonderful this was, tactical innovation. Well, Dan Biggar's just found another opportunity for tactical innovation. So do I think that one's unfair? I honestly do not think that one is unfair. I think that is one team 100% catching out another team by being 100% alert, 100% aware, 100% creative. In what they were doing. I thought they absolutely nailed it and the conference do it as well. And if players on the other side had been a bit more aware, then, you know, they'd probably saved it. Because Johnny Way and Daly, they'd nailed it on their side just because then with their teammates being a bit more aware on the other side. And would I be saying the same the other way around? Yeah, I think I would be on that one. I'd be equally aggrieved on the Zammit Liam Williams picture. I'd be equally aggrieved as the, you know, a lot of fans are there, but the other one, no, I'm pretty comfortable that Wales have scored an absolute beauty there.
Oh well, I'm quite happy to take that, and that seems like the ideal opportunity to head into a quick break. We've got more questions to look at, and of course, we'll be looking ahead to the final two games of the Six Nations, or the final two rounds of the Six Nations, which might give Wales an opportunity at the Grand Slam. Right, we'll be back after this short break. Welcome to the second half of the Attacking Scrum podcast, where, again, you won't be able to see this, but all four of us have had beaming smiles across our faces throughout the whole of this. I was saying before we started, sometimes it can be a bit of a chore when you're trying to pick out some highlights of a Pro 14 weekend that hasn't offered a lot. But yeah, days like this, it makes it all worthwhile. And hopefully you're feeling the same as our loyal listeners as well. And one man who is Rhys Lloyd. His questions come in and said, blue skies, sun out. Why isn't more professional rugby played in the spring, summer, when it isn't cold and wet? It's interesting. Obviously, I think the reason why is because of because of self-interest and the inability to have a global calendar. But it does make a difference, doesn't it, Dan? How much do you find, you know, that there is a bit more intent when we hit rugby in nicer weather?
Yeah, naturally there's going to be, isn't there? Because you think your tactics are probably going to be a little bit different, and also you feel different, don't you? If we can just move it on to a fan's perspective, just seeing some of the photos of Cardiff and how it was, blue skies, it just felt, it's such a shame, isn't it? There was no fans around, but what a great day. And obviously with us being down in London as well, the weather was superb, and just that real good feel-good factor, I think that comes across with the players as well, doesn't it? But I don't know, potentially we'll see more games in the future in warmer climates, maybe. I mean, you know a good bit about this, don't you?
Well, I don't know if I know a good bit about it. I think I don't know. From my point of view, you know, and I can sit here and be idealistic about it, I think if you're trying to create a better product in the Northern Hemisphere, then I think it does help if you play it in the summertime. I think there's lots of advantages to it. I think that, you know, the thing from a commercial perspective, that if you want to attract new fans in, you've got to have a more, you know, it's got to be concentrated around, you know, around more attacking rugby than perhaps you see during the winter months. But the other big advantage is, you know, you're not competing against football. So people who might be casual rugby fans who aren't necessarily into the club scene, for example, you'd have much more chance of kind of bringing them into the sport if you're not competing against something like the Premier League. So yeah, I think there are a lot of advantages to it. And Garrett, what about this, you know, about this from an actual kind of, I guess, tactical and skills point of view? Because, you know, obviously New Zealand produced some of the most skillful players in the world. And if I've ever seen a might attend game on TV, it's tipping it down half the time. Is it a bit of a myth that that this is, you know, that a lot of it is down to weather, or actually is it backed up in the way the games play out in the winter versus the summer?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the New Zealand winter. I mean, that's not dissimilar in terms of some of the atrocious weather they get. And you see with the rain, they get some serious downfall. The South Island sees a decent bit of rain. So does that hold water? I'm not fully convinced. But then, having said that, there's no doubt that we're seeing a different game in kind of September through to early November, and then we see a different game as of end of February. Within what, a day last week, all of a sudden winter left and spring arrived, and the game changes pretty immediately. I mean, we've seen some outrageous rugby across all levels in the last few days. So there's no doubt the weather changes it, and at community level, that's particularly the case. I mean, as coaches, we talk about winter rugby, and it's a definitive point in time. You get to mid-November, like our tactical plan changes, the game changes, and everything changes. I mean, training nights change, boys getting out of the change rooms and out onto the park is more challenging. Boy, numbers of guys training is more difficult. So it's, and even training pitches, I mean, most community pitches really suffer in the winter, and they struggle with drainage and like all the things you don't really think about, like floodlit pitches have enough facilities, and the winter months they do change that fairly dramatically. There's also, of course, the flip side to it. The pitches are significantly harder when you play in the summer, particularly in high summer, to the point where you just don't do contact when it's really hard. Really warm. We had some seriously warm days in the summer. If we were playing matches in those days, I'd be seriously concerned for the players' welfare. That's not to say that the rugby isn't played in hot countries. I get that, but it's not like we're acclimatized to it over a long period of time. We might get 3 weeks of horrendous heat. That's probably the only 3 weeks we get of the year. You could argue a lot of countries are playing in that weather. They're acclimatized into that over a lifetime, not over 3 weeks. So it's a bit more complex, maybe. But I think there's something in maybe a winter break. I mean, there's potentially something in that. Start your season off, take 8 weeks out of your season when the weather's just utterly atrocious and your pitches are getting absolutely hammered, and then pick back up and play a bit later. So play kind of April, May, when we're drawing a close. That could be peak season, couldn't it? Which would be pretty cool in terms of spectatorship and going out to see them. So there's yards in it, but it's, yeah, not probably not not too black and white, that one.
Sticking with kind of, yeah, those serious points, Murph, do you prefer to watch rugby whilst drinking in the summer, or is it actually in the winter it gets you out of a bit of a dark spot? Because that's what really matters.
Yeah, it's all about me. Did I call Leon Brownlee on Lloyd earlier?
Yes, you did. And I was I wondered if anyone playing Murph Bingo had, you know, had 15 minutes on the clock for that one, the sweepstake.
If this wasn't Zoom, I'd get up and go home right now. Storm off.
Oh, yeah, so
what was the question?
Do you
fuck all that? No, excuse my French. No, I'm a winter guy. I agree. Sometimes when you get like really poor conditions, I mean, if you go back far enough, some pitches in Wales were just, it's a very South Wales saying, but some pitches are like the inside of a Clark's pie for most of the winter, you know, like the Brewery Field in particular, and quite a few of them. You're just playing on a, you know, rubbish surface, and surfaces are much better than they used to be. And I suppose it's the argument for fake pitches if you want going to play all through the winter, you know, like at the Arms Park these days. But I don't know. It probably would, you'd be out of the way that, like you said, out of the way of the football season, but the football season only stops at about 2 months, less on a major tournament season, it's even less than that. So I don't know if we're out of the way that much. And then you're treading on shows of cricket and there's all issues with the, the front row forwards are going to have to lose weight just to be able to play in that kind of heat.
Well, so Leon Brown's turned into Leon Lloyd in the space of one podcast. So,
I'll just point out it's the Leon bit that I got confused with, not the fact that they're both, you know, mixed race gentlemen.
I don't think anyone was assuming that.
Yeah, so, good. Yeah, I mean, the teenagers wouldn't even remember Leon Lloyd anyway.
So. Oh yeah, there's stacks of teenagers who listen to this podcast. I'm sure that's a really strong demographic. We're massive amongst whatever it is, Generation Z. Right, let's take a look at this one. This one's from Alan Howley. I want to throw this one to you, Geraint. Were our centre partnership exposed to having two playmakers playing against them? I'm not so sure they were. What did you make of how the centres went? I know you were very excited about it in the lead up to the game.
Yeah, irrational excitement, to be honest. When I saw the team sheet, I think Foxy is just an unbelievable rugby player. So putting those two together on paper, it just worked. It sung lots of happy songs to me on the sheet itself. And then watch them play. I like the way that Jos North was used, actually in a more of a centre type role, ironically. So he did a lot of the carrying, but from decent angles, and allowed maybe Foxy to kind of build off a little bit, which I thought was nice balance. Were they exposed defensively? I'll be honest, I haven't spotted any clips that would suggest that. I think we were gotten outside of with startling ease when England played with that incredible intensity on maybe three occasions we've got outside of. I would say it's a centre partnership that were at fault there. That was more split defence where we had to go really passive as a team of three on the outside. But then I thought Zamit on the edge of it managed that really well. So, I didn't spot that, if I'm honest.
Yeah, I mean, particularly that tackle on, I think it was on Elliot Daly, wasn't it, where Zamit just showed the wheels, but also wrapped him kind of rugby league man and ball style to stop the offload. I thought that was it. That was exceptionally good defence. But I don't know. I mean, I can't get over the lad's pace. Like I know it's mad, but it's not just where he's, you know, where he's got a breakaway like he did at the end. It's just every aspect of the game. I think he makes it look so much easier because his acceleration and his pace is just, you know, it's incredible. And the thing that I find most incredible about it is he's lightning quick in an era when everyone is quick. You know, it's not like, you know, you don't get international wingers who aren't, you know, serious athletes in this day and age. And he looks miles quicker than any of them. I mean, yeah, I'm blown away with excitement about the kid. He is, you know, he's the real deal for me.
Yeah, definitely. For me, I mean, I think he's outstanding. I was out of mid quite public. I think he's got loads of good components to his game. I mean, he's a young lad. I mean, if you look at his potential, that's pretty huge. Just got to kind of celebrate where he is right now, really. Just be kind of pleased with where he's at. I was actually pleased that Wales used him on first phase because I actually think he needs a little bit of that in his game. A little bit of first phase in your face, set field position. And I think if he can kind of get himself into that little bit, like George North is used effectively, kind of get into the face of the opposition. I'd quite like to see him in those spaces, which will then supplement his ability to just be rapid in the outside spaces as well.
No, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Another one, actually, I think it's just part of Greg's question from earlier. Who's playing themselves in and out of the Lions? Now, I know we often say, when's it too early to talk about the Lions? But In a year like this, until it happens, I think it probably is too early. But from a form perspective, Dan, who has enhanced their Lions claims from either of those sides that you saw on Saturday?
Well, from a skipper's perspective, I thought Alan Wynne-Jones was unbelievable. I mean, superhuman. The dominant tackles he was putting in. I mean, some of the hits were just incredible. Work rate, everything that we've known about him, and he. Yeah, I was hoping that he'd school at Toji, and he did, and just they weren't in the same league for me. It was absolutely outstanding performance. Justin Tipperick, that he went under the radar yesterday was so good, absolutely brilliant. He's a player that I don't think we'll ever see a player like that again for me. I thought he was world class, and Faletau was equally world class as well. So, but yeah, I'll let a few of the guys, you know, talk about a couple of others. But for me, Alan Wynne-Jones, Faletau, and Tips or something else.
Murph, let's throw to you perhaps for players who didn't enhance their claims.
I was going to mention Billy Vunipola anyway, because Dan mentioned him in terms of Alamin Jung smashing into him all the time, and I was almost starting to feel sorry for him as the game drew on, because they seemed to be not kicking directly to him, but kicking when he was in the backfield. Mm. Obviously, then the English player would look for him, and he was running up the pitch, and you could see after a while that Wales were happy for him to be running at him. And it was either Alan Wynne or Navidi. Navidi is so good at defending Billy. He didn't have the best defensive display against Billy that he did. And the last time he played him, I can't remember if it was home or away, but just completely bottled him up in one game. I felt sorry for him. No, I didn't feel sorry for him on that occasion, but yesterday I did. And when you've got Josh in the side and then Alan Wynne playing like that as well, it doesn't matter who the carrier is. I mean, as long as you're not massively on the back foot, you can just soak him up. And he's one of aside from being ridiculously strong, Josh Navidi seems to be able to tackle nice and high without slipping up and making it a high tackle and getting penalised. He always grabs him just under the shoulder and checks him, and then someone else pounces on him. And just, I mean, I don't know what his stats were. He did have a lot of carries, but it wasn't like, I'm not saying he's completely out of the reckoning for the Lions, but it wasn't like making himself undroppable for the Lions. He didn't do that at all.
I mean, yeah, I said when we did our Six Nations preview show, which is going to go down as like one bloke having got so many things wrong in the space of an hour. I said that the Saracens players being able to manage their workload would definitely enhance England's claim. It couldn't be further from the truth. I think all of those key players who, you know, obviously thrive off the intensity of playing at the highest level, you know, they look completely different. And you know, Billy's one of them. Owen Farrell is bang out of form. I disagree slightly with Dan on Itoje. He gave away a lot of penalties, which I know everyone's given him stick for. But at the same time, that's the way he plays. I think sometimes that happens. The one where he slapped Kieran Hardy's arm, I thought that was pretty harsh. You know, it's one where he's going for the arm and he's got the ball. I didn't think it was necessarily a deliberate knock on. There was a couple of tight calls. You know, I still think he's close to, if not the first name on the team sheet. But yeah, the other Saris players, I think are looking sluggish. Garrett, what are your thoughts on those? You know, on the Saris contingent, because when you've got such a core of players from one side who've been so successful, how important is it that you're playing regularly and playing at a high level?
Yeah, of course it matters. I suppose you could argue there's a few of the Welsh boys who haven't played a great deal of rugby. Foxy didn't look off the pace today. He hadn't played much rugby. So you look at, I don't know if that's the argument, really. I don't know if that's the thing that we can settle on that explains England's form right now. Look at Mako. I thought Mako had a solid game. In fact, he was probably one of the guys for England that contributed to them getting onto the front foot on occasions. Billy is, it just feels like he's just been found out a little bit. And guys are then teaming up on him, and you know, the best players always come through that. So I certainly wouldn't write him off. He's been outstanding for a number of years. And as the best players, they do get worked out, every single one of them. And then they find something new and they step up a level again. George North is a perfect example. Had a bit of a lull period, and then now he's looking sharp as ever. So you know, Farrell, I'm not certain that the game is suiting him massively, to be honest. Him and Ford, double playmakers, great if you want to move the ball a bit, but if you want to kick the ball and then not really play too many phases and expect to get opportunities in opposition half, then it doesn't do him much good. So he hasn't looked great, has he? But I don't think the game suits them a great deal either. This multiple kick game, I mean, it's already out of fashion. That's 4 or 5 games into it from the autumn series. So, yeah, those guys are looking good. And then guys like Eli Daly, I mean, if you look at the other players who just haven't struck any form, like he's probably one of those. And you look at a player like Mullins, who I think is outstanding. If you were England right now, you probably want to get some of those guys in. Ben Young's got a cracking try. Not convinced he's done a huge amount more, really, but you probably... England do have choices to mix up those areas, and in the position they're in, why wouldn't they change it?
How many tries has he scored against Wales out of interest? I feel like he always scores. He's one of those players like Will Greenwood who just is always on the score sheet when we play against them. Probably how England fans feel about Corey Hill now, I think. But yeah, he always seems to score. But yeah, no, some really interesting points in there. This question came in from Patrick. How much credit does Pivac deserve for bringing Mellon in? Obviously, this is something you touched on right at the start of the show, Geraint. He's had a massive impact, hasn't he?
Massive. I think, and it was immediate. It was literally not like a few games that lead into it. It was the next game that Wales' defence was better. So against England, the Park of Scarlets, Wales weren't really in the game. Like they were played out of it in lots of ways, but definite improvements defensively. And then stepping through the Championship so far against Ireland, against Scotland. Yeah, it's been huge. I mean, and a lot of it is, a lot of the ex-Welsh players have commented on the attitude that was present previously. That appears to be there. It's such a, maybe it's an intangible, isn't it, attitude, but it's the thing that really drives your defence. And the intensity of the guys to scoot around the corner, get up off the ground, make tackles. I just think that it looks like he simplified our system a bit. It's less kind of hell for leather out of the blocks, which Byron Hayward brought in. It's now just stay connected, get off the line, stay connected, make your tackle in twos, get off the ground, back on feet, 14 in the front line whenever we can. And yeah, I think he's had a solid impact.
Dan, how much of that though is kind of credit to Pivac for you know, I guess having the guts to get rid of his appointment. And, you know, I know, like, we don't know exactly what it is, but your gut would tell you that was a decision that was made and then, you know, and then brought him in. How much of that credit goes to Pivac, do you think?
Yeah, we don't know exactly what went on, do we? But if we look at it on face value, yeah, you've got to give a lot of credit to Pivac, haven't you? He's been under a lot of pressure. And you totally agree with Geraint that it was instant, wasn't it? You could see the difference in players' attitude then on the defensive line the moment he came in, and it seemed like he simplified things and you know, really got the players buying. And there seemed to be an attitudinal shift, really, didn't there, when he came in. And I just think that's coming more and more to the fore with every game that we go into now. So, it's fantastic. I'm absolutely delighted that he's there, as probably all Welsh fans are. But you've got to give the coaching staff credit, haven't we?
Yeah, look, absolutely. We're starting to come towards the end of the show now, as we start to run out of time a bit. This question is from Robert Giannotti. I'm going to throw this one to you, Murph. Are some of the Gatland-era stalwarts like John Fox, Halfpenny, and to a lesser extent Bigger, starting to look like square pegs in round holes for Pivac's side?
I'm not so sure. I mean, the biggest issue with all of them is Father Time. You know, funny enough, someone printed when the team was announced, all their kind of age caps and everything. And you know, it is getting to be quite an old side now, this side. There's one who never gets mentioned for age is Ken Owens. Ken Owens is 34. All the back row are 30 plus. So, you know, I don't know. Good players will play under, really good players like Jonathan Davis, for example, will play under any system. So I don't know if you could ever call him a square peg. It just might be that he's past his best. As time goes on, I mean, if he makes it to the next World Cup, that'll be a remarkable effort. You know, even though, you know, things have started to go well, and I could not be happier, and I wanted Scott Robertson to take his place a fortnight ago. So, you know, all I can do is apologise to Wayne. Well done. But we haven't reinvented the wheel. All we've done is get everything in place. Like, the set piece works, the defence works. Like, defensive, we mentioned defence in the last question just now. Defensive shape was shocking in the autumn. You had people like George North, who is very experienced test lion, flying out of the system and leaving massive holes in behind, and Justin Tiprick. So is it George or is it a defensive system? Is it Tiprick or is it a defensive system? Why would players like that suddenly turn into, you know, clueless, headless chickens? So, you know, we've changed the coach and now there's a decent shape there. And obviously, the I think the attitude might have been there the whole time. It's just, if there's a massive M4-sized gap outside you, attitude doesn't save you, no matter what your attitude is. So, yeah, I gladly buy Wayne Pivac a pint, but let's not get carried away. He's not. We've just got everything in place now. Set piece, defence, kicker. And then we can play from there. But you know, he's not the second coming of Calvin James yet.
Right. Let's finish then by having a look ahead to the Italy game. I mean, you'd look at that. You know, I said at the start of the tournament when Wales were out of form that I thought they'd be targeting this game as a potential upset. You can't really see that happening right now. But at the same time, I wouldn't be tempted to make hardly any, if any, changes. What would you be thinking, Geraint, if you were picking that side for the Italy game?
Yeah, continuity is key. I think Pivac has done a decent job with his selection recently, which I don't mean that sounds quite condescending. He's an international coach, but he's done a really good job with his selections in that he's rotated just a couple of players and he's kept overall consistency, but he's swapped two or three key numbers in, and then changed a couple of positions around as well. The adaptation between Ireland and Scotland was really good based on injury and availability. And I would hope he does the same again. So I wouldn't expect to see the same starting 15, but I would expect there to be a couple of changes in there, dependent on obviously fitness, some of you with a couple of key players. If Hardy is fit and able, you probably want to see him start again, to be honest. Gareth Davis would be itching for a 9 spot, but just feel that Hardy just needs a little bit of continuity at this point. And I think the squad's like that. So yeah, a couple of boys coming in, and maybe somebody like Corey Hill coming in to start instead of coming off the bench. Seeing both of them starting instead of coming off the bench, I think he's a destroyer of rucks and of ball carriers. So it'd be great to see him getting a real chunk of the game. So yeah, just two or three really targeted changes would be cool.
Dan, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd make a change at hooker. So I give Ken a rest and make a change in the second row. I'd probably leave Alan Wynn out and a change in the back row as well. And bar that, I'd keep it. Keep the continuity going. I think it's absolutely key. Like I alluded to earlier, we made a lot of changes, didn't we? In the autumn, and I think we just need to keep some continuity, but make a couple of cute changes.
Fair enough. Right. Okay. I suppose the big question is then, are Wales on for a Grand Slam? Who wants to take that? Well, in fact, I'm going to ask all of you. So go on, Murph.
There's rumours that the French government, I don't know where, my neighbour told me. I mean, he's a reliable bloke.
Good.
He's a doctor, so you can rely on him. But he reckons there's rumours the French government are going to pull the rugby team out because of the outbreak. It's not just in the French men's team, it's in the French women's team and the French sevens team. I don't know if they've got the same training base or what, but there's a proper problem going on there. So there is a rumor that the French government is going to say stuff that, in which case we can't win a Grand Slam, but they will have to forfeit their matches, France, if they can't play another one. It would be a championship, not a Grand Slam, would they?
If they forfeit the game, we win 28-0, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, God, just when you thought you could, like, people are saying this is the luckiest triple crown ever. I mean,
I mean, France. I still think France is the best team in it. Myself,
honestly, I genuinely think if we got on the pitch with France, I could see us losing by 20 points, but putting in by far and away our best performance. You know what I mean? You could see the momentum really building, but then in France meeting someone who are in really, really good nick and potentially very, very frightening when they play. Mm. But all right, so we're going, if there's an outbreak, then yes. if not, then no. Geraint, Grand Slam, is it on?
I said it again before the championship there. Never discount Wales winning Grand Slams. kind of early to the 2000s, throughout the 90s, very different mindset. But as of that fine evening in 2005, I haven't felt any different about this Welsh team. I think they are capable of winning the Grand Slam without any shadow of a doubt. I think France are one of the finest rugby teams to watch on the planet right now. I think they are incredible. I still think Wales can beat them, even with their strongest team.
Which means the final say comes to you, Dan.
Grand Slam's on. really on. I love the look of the French side. I do. Really exciting to watch, but I just think we're winning, but we're not playing, we haven't clicked yet, and each game at the moment we're just getting quietly better. I really hope that French game does take place. I want that to take place. And yeah, for me, the Grand Slam is on.
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, I'd rather we played France for a shot at the Grand Slam and didn't win it than we won it by, you know, by some kind of default. You know, we want it to take place on the pitch, and you want to take on the best sides, don't you? So, yeah, all of that to come, and that pretty much brings us to a conclusion for this week. A big thanks to. Our regular co-host to Murph and to Dan, and a big thanks to Geraint for joining us as well. I suppose I should actually thank our real sponsor, which is, of course, our good friends at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get your hands on some great quality coffee, you can do that at socoffeetrades.co.uk. But yeah, we will continue to build up this this Grand Slam hype wagon on next week's show, and we'll be back to chat rugby with you very, very soon. Thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.